Hello and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire and Border Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me to discuss minutes 90 to 95 of Citizen Kane is frequent Fire and Water guest and my pal, Corey Drew. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Rob.
You have now crossed the Rubicon in terms of how many shows you have guested on. I think you probably have the record at this point, because we're talking Pod Dylan, Film and Water, Fire and Water. Give me those Star Trek. Give me those Star Wars. we're running out of shows for you. I mean, we've got to get into Super Friends, I guess, at some point. We've got to get you on Super Friends.
I'd love to.
Treasury Cast. But, I mean, really, you are quickly becoming the number one all-star guest of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
I'm the Soupy Sales of the Fire and Water Network. Is that a sufficiently old-timey reference?
There we go, for everybody to enjoy that old-timey. So, anyway, I am very glad you're here. I'm excited to talk about these minutes with you. It's going to, as I said, it's 90 to 95. They're going to start with Jed at the opera, and they're going to end with some Inquirer headlines. But before we get to these minutes, Corey, I have to ask you, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
Well, let's see. I can estimate approximately. Well, it was 1993. It was actually, I can tell you exactly when it was. One second. It was Friday, November 5th, 1993.
Wow.
At 10 a.m.
What? Okay.
And I can tell you why I know that. Which is probably the more interesting part than the actual date and time. But the reason I know that is because I first saw it in a film studies course that I took, like literally 90% of the other people to have appeared on this podcast. And do you appear on a podcast? Anyway.
that's an interesting theological, well, not theological, philosophical question.
It was in my intro to film studies class, and I remember the date because it was the day before my birthday, and it was my the last day of the week for that class, and my class was Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was the day before my birthday. That class was at 10 a.m. and we watched it as it was the first like full film that we sat down to watch in the semester. So we had done a lot of like studying up until that point of films and watched like clips and short reels and that sort of thing up until that point. But the first film that we were going to watch, was Citizen Kane in its entirety, followed by, Birth of a Nation. Now, I don't know why we did it in this order. And I don't exactly know why we watched all of Birth of a Nation. That didn't feel entirely necessary to me, to be honest with you. But I suppose at the end of the course, you're meant to critique the films that you've seen or critique a new film, you probably ought to be able to do that. And Birth of a Nation gives you plenty to criticize. So we watched it that day. And the reason I remember it is because it happened, as I said, the day before my birthday. I fell so in love with this movie that it's become one of my birthday movies. You have Mountain Comics. I have birthday movies. it's a handful of films. Jason and the Argonauts, Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon, and Empire Strikes Back.
I don't think I knew Maltese Falcon was on that list. I certainly knew about Jason and the Argonauts, but
right,
I didn't know
right,
about
course,
Maltese
yeah.
Falcon.
Yep, Maltese Falcon and The Empire Strikes Back. And they are movies that I watch, certainly maybe not every year, right? But on my birthday, I have a Jones to watch films. One of those movies I will certainly watch, usually multiples, and pretty frequently Citizen Kane falls into that category. But I remember it because it just felt like, you know, it was my first year in college. I was taking a class, literally the first class I ever took where I thought, yo, this is college. Like, I am learning the good stuff now. Like, I am not learning the Pythagorean theorem anymore. I am not you know, reading The Return of the Native, which, you know, don't get me started. But like, you know, like I was sitting there, like I'm learning the good stuff. And then when you sit down and, you know, you think you have this idea, I think when you're sort of like pre-film fan, right? You have this idea of what movies are important movies, right? And when, you know, when in my age and with my social circle, those movies were like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the other one? Sid and Nancy. A very, you know, that was like a movie. Everybody's like,
That was not the title. I didn't know what you were going to say.
Not where you thought I was going.
Not expecting that one, certainly.
Reefer Madness. Like, these are the movies that like my little circle of friends were like, yo, these movies, there's some stuff going on here. You got to watch these movies. They're not just movies, man. They're films. And it's like, you know, so like in my head, like that's what I think I'm going to watch. And that is none of that, right? Like literally none of that happened. Maybe a little bit of Reefer Madness in that course. But it was all pretty intense, like filmic stuff. And then to watch Citizen Kane, which I had probably seen, I don't know, bits and pieces of like on late night television or, you know, just I had an awareness of it, but it wasn't really knew much about it. I saw Orson Welles, of course, to me was the wine guy. Right. He was on I Love Lucy. He was, I don't know. Something makes me think he might've been a voice on like Scooby-Doo or somebody imitating him.
If like, not Scooby-Doo, this, nearly everything else.
Yeah. Right. Like I just sort of had this idea of who he was. But then to sit down and to have somebody come in and tell you, so, okay, so here's this film, we're going to watch it. And this particular instructor did not tell us much about it going in.
Perfect.
Like he gave us all of this stuff. And oh, a whole other piece of this I forgot to tell you about, but they gave us all this stuff going up to it from other movies, right? Like that other films had done. And like, you know, the sort of language of movies up until that point. And then he's like, okay, and now watch this. And, you know, what do you think about that? You know, and at the end, most of us, well, some of us had seen it before, right? But for me, I was like, well, that changed everything. Everything is different now, like mm-hmm. after having seen this movie. And I fell in love with it so hard that it became a birthday movie.
That's marvelous. That's a great
And that is why I can estimate approximately when I saw this film.
That's fantastic. That's like the moon landing, you know, like you knew where you were. But that's the perfect way for your instructor to bring it to you. Cause everyone's heard of the movie. Certainly you may not know much about it, but that's great that he didn't lard it up with, you're going to love this. It's a classic, all that stuff. That's mm-hmm. great that he just said, let's just watch it. That's perfect. Good on him.
So the part that I forgot to mention was that I, of course, I'm certain I've told you about this time in my life when I walked around with a copy of On the Road in my back pocket, because that's just who I was, right? Like I was that guy with the copy of On the Road in his back pocket. I wanted you to know it, and I would whip that shit out anytime I had an opportunity. Even just like casually, just like, oh, I'm just sitting here. All right. Time for somebody to see me reading On the Road. You know what I mean? Like is that
cover out.
Yeah, exactly. A little beaten, a little dog eared, you know, so they know I've read it a lot. But like that's sort of the phase of my life that I was in, insufferable as it was. But I also kept a copy of Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge printed on my binder that I would walk around with in class, like my homework, like basically my trapper keeper. But you know, two kittens hanging on was just not like cool for like a college kid. Irony hadn't kicked in yet. So I had literally handwritten all of the lyrics to Kubla Khan, the poem, and I had it on my binder on the outside of my trapper keeper. And the instructor, you know, was chatting with me, and he caught the poem there, and he said, oh, I think you're probably going to like some of the stuff that goes on in Citizen Kane because of your poem.
Right.
I'm like, all right. So I was just like intrigued going in. And of course it opens basically the same way the poem does. And I'm like, oh, I'm in. I don't care what happens next. I am in. Add some Muppets. I am thrilled. Like, I was just right there for it.
In your mind back then, what did you think that having that printed signified? I know what you were trying to achieve by having the on the road, but like, what in your mind, what did you think people, what were you hoping people were going to get out of seeing that you had Kubla Khan printed out like that?
Yeah, I wanted to go like all of those things that you do, all those affectations that you have as like a person, right? It is it's to drive engagement with other people. And I've actually thought about this question, so thank you for asking. and it's to drive engagement with other people, with other, you know, human beings. And human beings that you have something in common with, you know, that's why, like, you know, you have, like, your Aquaman coat, right? Like, you wear that out into the world where you know other people who are going to appreciate it will see it and be like, yo, that's dope.
Absolutely, yes.
So for me, I really, really, really liked the band Rush, right? You know the band,
sure,
the Canadian progressive rock, right? And they had a song, called Xanadu, was just the name of the song. And it was based off of that poem, but it was like a sci-fi version of it. So like, to my way of thinking, having that there would signify, hopefully, to other people who were Rush fans, right? But also fans of sort of trippy, like psychedelic poetry. Not that it was psychedelic, but, you know, like just poetry in general and kind of sci-fi fantasy vibes, that it would, you know, trigger somebody who enjoyed that type of stuff to have a conversation with me, because that's back then we didn't have the internet. We couldn't just log on and be like, I want to talk to other people who love Star Trek like I did.
Right.
It wasn't like that. You had to advertise this shit. You had to be out there and say, this is my weirdness. If this is your weirdness, talk to me. It never once worked in the case of I guess that's not true, because my professor noted it, but he noted it from a completely different angle. He didn't note it from the Rush angle. And frankly, I had been burned by wearing an Atlas Shrugged t-shirt, because the people who reach out to you about having Ayn Rand information on you are very different, right? Like, are very different than, and again, like that, like I liked Ayn Rand. I liked Atlas Shrugged as a book, not necessarily, it's not at all, it's messages, but just as a book, I liked that I had read it because it was big. And it seemed like smart people liked it, right? So again, it was totally an advertisement. It was kind of an affectation, but it was like, I had that, I was advertising that out to the world, and you get some interesting people who want to have conversations with you when you advertise that you like, you know, Atlas Shrugged, or, you know, if you have a Who is John Galt sticker on your car. Like,
oh, God.
These are things that they don't necessarily, I didn't understand the ramifications of what I was doing. You know what I mean? Like, and so I thought, well, I'm in college now. Maybe I can get a deeper level of casual connection by putting some poetry on my badge. Also, I just loved it. Like, I love that poem. It is good. And the song by Rush is good. Like, it's good. It's classic for a reason, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why I made a custom Orson Welles, Greg Toland t-shirt that I wear now. And I wear it out because I figure somebody at some point will maybe see it and appreciate what it is. Because I took literally the credit card from the beginning of Citizen Kane. Oh, no, excuse me, the end of Citizen Kane, of course. Where it has Wells's name on the same card as Greg Toland, which was really unheard of for the director to put his name on the same card as the cinematographer. But it was a tribute to how much Toland contributed to the film and I turned it into a t-shirt, and I wear it now, and no one has ever stopped me yet, but someday somebody probably will. And that, yeah, right. It's the exact thing. I'm sort of advertising. Not only do I love Citizen Kane, I kind of like really know the secret handshakes of Citizen Kane, which is,
it's, you know, a deeper level.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It's weird, right? It was a weird thing to do, and looking back on it, it's a little cringe, but actually at the same time, it fostered a conversation between me and my instructor, and it primed me to go into this film in a way that, I mean, you know, maybe if I didn't have an appreciation for that particular poem, you know, would have had a different impact on it.
Yeah, you might have. I mean, you probably would have seen Citizen Kane eventually, but you might have seen it in a very different context, mm-hmm. and maybe not enjoyed it the same way, or been as open to it as you were at the moment. So, yeah, that all really worked out. So, we have to thank
and you know,
professor.
Like, and right, and like, you know, to be honest with you, I'm watching Citizen Kane in this moment, like I kind of expect a sci-fi twist at some point. You know what I mean? Because I make this joke about how I would never, when I was a kid, if it didn't have wizards or lasers in it, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. Right. Right? That was just is there wizards? No. Are there lasers? No. Okay, thanks. The only exception to that was if there was Muppets. Then I was fine. I kind of watched it because, you know, up until this point, I had these connections in my head with this movie because it was black and white. It was, you know, to me, it felt older than it was. I don't know why, like it felt like it predated things. I think because it was so formative, for other movies, it predated things. And there was I was just sort of waiting for this sort of, like, Fritz Lang Metropolis twist to happen. You know what I mean? While I was watching it. And of course it never did. And I got to the end of the movie and I was like, well, I didn't give a damn that there was no wizards or lasers. This is amazing. and you know, I guess I could probably make an argument that it was all wizards and lasers if you press me, but, but it was just like, I just loved it.
Excellent. That's superb. Now, do you think, I've been asking people, well, I started the first half of the show asking people if they think it's the greatest film of all time, but I've been changing the question up a little bit to trying to get more like a baseline of what other people think is the greatest film of all time. Now, what would you consider some of the greatest films of all time? Again, not necessarily your favorites, but like some of the greatest. What do you think do you think Citizen Kane belongs in that pantheon? And what are just a couple of other films you think belong in that list?
I mean, to me, there is, I had an answer for this question and then you switch it up on me. So now
I'd like to
I have
that.
To, yeah, that's good. No, keep me on my toes. I like that. So 100%, unequivocally, it belongs in the pantheon of great films. Like it just does. It is so many things and it's all of them good, right? Not even good. All of them great. Like, you know, I push back at the notion of it being the greatest film of all time, right? Because, I mean, that's like, no one can know, right? Like, you just can't, like, nobody's seen every film. But also I push back against that because, like, for me, I wouldn't do that to Orson Welles, mm-hmm. because many people have. And I think, If you're a man like Orson Welles, right, and you think that you've reached the pinnacle of what you want to do, right, and you've reached it at 25, right, that is really, really crushing. But also what it means, what the inverse of that question, right, is like what that means is, nobody learned anything from you, right? Nobody took the work you did and built upon it. And we know that that's not true. Like we know that that's not true. So to say that there isn't a filmmaker out there who after Citizen Kane made a film that is an improvement upon the things that Citizen Kane implemented or began, I just don't think that that's likely. As a notion that very idea doesn't settle well with me. I don't think because something is first out of the gate, it's intrinsically the best. And just sort of by human nature, it can't be, right? Like the aqueducts are not the best plumbing, right? Like they're just not. Like the pyramids are not the best architecture. They're amazing, they're incredible works of feats of human ingenuity, and nobody would ever say that they're not instrumental in changing the world, right? And I think that that's true of Citizen Kane. I think that's very true. But I don't think it's fair to take Orson Welles and Greg Toland and everybody's great work and say, well, this was it. This is where it ended. Nobody learned from you. Nobody improved on what you did. Because I know, like, for me, as I age, I feel like I really want people to take what I do and build on it and grow from it and make it their own and do things with it to bring it into the future. Because if you don't, it just dies. You see it in fandom all the time. Like, people in fandom, they want things to be static sometimes, and they want it never to change. Whereas I'm sort of the opinion, I want a new generation to take it and go with it. And this is the last time I promise I will ever, that I will ever compare the Citizen Kane to what's that? What's the movie? It just came out, the animated movie with LeBron James.
Space Jam, A New Legacy.
Space Jam, A New Legacy. The last time I promise I will ever compare it. But that movie is not for me, right? That movie is not for anybody that loves Space Jam. That movie is for a new generation of people to learn from it, whatever lessons there are to learn from Space Jam, right? To enjoy it, whatever. And I think that that's great. And I think that that's how entertainment in particular, pop culture in particular, I think that's how these things should be. So for me, like, I'm sorry, that was probably a very loud noise. For me, Citizen Kane, like, I can't say it's the best film, but it is absolutely deserves to be in that pantheon. And I mean, for me, that includes, Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
I think undoubtedly that movie's astonishing. There's an animated film, called The Wind Rises. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a Hayao Miyazaki movie.
I've heard of it, but I've not seen it. No.
Absolutely heartbreaking and beautiful, and everything about the human experience in a very brief amount of time. You know, I don't think that we can talk about the greatest movies of all times if we don't talk about Fletch Lives. So,
whoa,
you know.
Man, you are all over the map here, Corey.
Space
Jam, A New Legacy, awesome. Fletch Lives, and Sid and Nancy, all in one podcast. That is
all in one podcast. I mean, I spend a lot of time watching a lot of movies, and I'll tell you what, only ever watched Fletch Lives once.
Yeah, well, you don't need to watch it more than once. Some would argue you don't even need to watch it even once.
I feel like I regretted it almost immediately.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. I had not thought of that, the idea that, yeah, you do kind of render film inert in some ways if you say 1941 Citizen Kane made by a 25-year-old, all right, we're done. We're done.
Right.
And it kind of reminds me of that axiom about if the student isn't better than the teacher, then the teacher has failed.
Exactly.
And so, that's a real, Wells himself would probably have said, no, some of my other films are better because I've learned things since then. That's a really, I never really quite thought of it that way, Corey, but I like that idea that, you know, Wells is hard at work on, you know, say The Other Side of Midnight. The Other Side of the Wind. Other Side of Midnight is another movie. Mm-hmm. Other Side of the Wind, a full 30 years after making Citizen Kane and having learned all the different things and having had so many life experiences, but then to someone just say, yeah, but it's still not as good as that other thing. That, yeah, I could see that would be quite depressing. It's like, well, geez, what's the point
what
of any of this?
That then? Would be.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about how much time he spent kind of like mentoring, like Peter Bogdanovich, for instance.
Yep, sure.
And the idea that Peter Bogdanovich could never pick up the ball and bring it further than he did, right? I'm not saying Peter Bogdanovich did, but I'm saying that never having, you know, that sort of assessing him as a director, as Orson Welles assessing him and saying, well, he's never going to do what I did. So what would be the point of all that mentoring? Right, like, what would be the point of that for him? And I just, for me, it doesn't sit well as a notion.
That's great. Yeah, that's marvelous. I really like that. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, I would argue. I mean, except I still kind of consider it that, but it's, again, it's just as much of a kind of a negative for people that want to just enjoy the movie. To this day, people still kind of like they have a grudge against the movie because it's been given all those hazanas before you've even had a chance to see it.
Oh, they get a chip on their shoulder, right? Yep. Like they sit down, they go, yeah, you think so? You think this is the best movie ever made? Well, I'm going to tell you 16 reasons why it's not in the first 10 minutes. And it's like, well, okay.
Right. And you go into it with that agenda, you'll definitely find things. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. So, all right. Well, that's fantastic. So, all right. So we're here to talk about, like I said, minutes 90 to 95. We're going to start with Jed at the opera. And I love it. Right off the bat, we see that Jed is not enjoying the opera because he's already looking half asleep. And he is staring at his program sort of absentmindedly because the opera has been on all of, about 30 seconds and he's already completely bored. And we just know by how Susan is singing and it's not looking great. And we see Bernstein and some of other Kane's, presumably his employees looking on in the back, and there they all have these sort of grim faces. And it's interesting that Bernstein is kind of looking at the crowd to see what their reaction is, almost like he's almost looking out for his boss to see, hey, is everybody here enjoying this? He's kind of almost like in a weird way policing them to a certain extent. Like, everybody in line here, everybody's enjoying this, right? But the truth is inescapable.
Yeah, that particular, like Leland in particular, looks so strung out in that moment. Like he looks, they did such a great job with his makeup there. And it's not even old age makeup. They're just like, we're going to make you look tired. You are tired of this. Charles Foster Kane and his shenanigans have ground you down. And this is that scene where you see that in his face. He's just like, oh, God, this. this I have to sit and endure for my friend. The other things that I've endured up until this point have not been sufficient. Now I have to sit and listen to, his significant other shriek for whatever the length of an opera is meant to be.
Ooh, they're long too. They're not 95 minutes or anything.
They're not known for their brevity. No.
No. Oh boy. And I always wonder about the singing voice coming out of Dorothy Cumming-Orr, because that's clearly, obviously, that's not her. And I always wondered, is that a actual good singer singing badly, or is that a bad singer singing badly? Like, did they get somebody who they knew couldn't sing and had them sing and pipe it in? Or do you get a good singer and ask the singer to kind of just be off pitch a little? I don't know what the best way is to do that.
I think that there's like two different angles that you could take there. You could either decide that you really just want the verisimilitude of having somebody that can't sing, but I think to sound bad, to hit the wrong notes correctly, you have to be a pretty talented singer. And you know what's funny is I noted while I was reading that, while I was watching it, I noted on my cards, I'm like, I don't think this is that bad. I mean, I don't think it's great, right? Like, I wouldn't want to listen to it or whatever. But I don't think she's, and we'll get to it in just a moment, but I think she sort of hit the nail on the head later on when she's talking to Charlie about why it was such an abysmal disaster. And I don't necessarily think that it's because she wasn't great at it, right? Like, I think a part of it is that she signaled to people she wasn't like them. She's not the right type of person to be doing this. And I think that in that sort of high society, that is worse than being bad at it. You know, I had the shades of that, like a Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah, the Meryl Streep movie, yeah.
Right. But she was like an upper class lady, right? Like she was a real New York upper class lady. So people were like, oh no, you're doing wonderfully, darling. And she wasn't, right? But now here is Susie, which I like to call her Susie because I think it's very charming when they called her that in the film earlier. She she comes out and she belts it out, admittedly poorly, but poorly in a way that sort of indicates a lack of class, right?
Huh.
And to me, that was the read that I got, was that it wasn't, because like it's immediate, right? Like it is immediate. They cut to her singing and immediately, one of the guests in the audience says, "Perfectly dreadful."
Perfectly dreadful.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Like immediately, right out the gate. So it's like, no, she signaled something, right? Like that was the vibe that I was picking up. That doesn't mean that's right, but that's my read.
That's interesting. I've never thought of it like that. Now, you're blowing my mind here, Corey. I had never considered it like that. I always just thought, well, she's just bad, and that's it. I mean, there is a moment where she's sitting down on the stage, and she's got all these surrounded by all these people in costumes, and she starts to sing, and then we do a cut to her opera coach. Sitting in that little, I don't know the name of that little thing that's on the stage where the opera coach
Know what that's called.
Yeah, I don't
either,
know what that's called. I'm sure it's got a name. But there's a point where he's lifting his hand up, directing her. And in that moment, he does look like maybe she's pulling this off. In a moment, we're going to see him, you know, get frustrated. But he is, in that moment, at least briefly, kind of like, okay. Like,
yeah, maybe
almost,
we're there. Yep.
Maybe we're going to get there. So I hadn't really thought about the idea that people in the crowd know that she is Charles Foster Kane's, I mean, she's his wife now, but everyone knows the story that she was the mistress that ended his run for governor. And then she comes from the, you know, kind of a low station. And that's a really interesting idea that these sort of like opera snobs are just like, who is this, you know, who's this girl to be trying to do opera? I'd never thought of it that way.
And like, I'm not familiar with, you know, 19, you know, Gilded Age era operatic costuming, really. But if you look at her costume, it was a little trashy. Her bustier has nipples. You know,
it's a lot of skin. She's showing a lot of skin.
She's showing a lot of skin, but she like her bustier itself has like, it looks like, it literally looks like old Benny Hill shorts where they would like take a grapefruit and put a cherry in the middle. Do you know what I mean? Look, it's, you know, two boobs. you know, like it definitely had like this sensibility to me where it's like, this isn't as refined and sophisticated as these people want. And frankly, I don't know that it ever could be, right? Because they've made up their mind about her before she really opens her mouth to sing. They don't give her a chance to be successful. Hmm. And I think she sees that too. You know, she sees that from right there. And she even sort of says it in the next scene.
Yeah, right. When she's the post mortem of the piece, we see Bernstein fall asleep at one point and wake himself up. I've been to some movies. I think when you and I went to the New Beverly that one time, I think we were watching movies at 3 a.m.
It was 3 a.m.
It was 3 a.m. I'm old, and it was 3 a.m. I was like, all right, I'm really struggling to get through candy here. At,
I was going to say it was 3 a.m. and it was candy. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I did my best. But we see him wake up and kind of jolt himself up. And then we cut to Leland, who has made this sort of confetti fan of the program. And I kind of like that it's very specific what he's making. He's not just shredding it. He's tearing it into strips, but leaving kind of the binding intact. So it has like a fan. And we're going to see in a minute that it becomes... It's just like an object that he's making. So he's kind of really focused on this thing. He's not just absentmindedly, you know, tearing the label off your bottle of beer. He's actually sort of making an object out of this thing because he's so bored with what's going on at the stage.
And like from like a symbolic perspective, right? Like he's literally shredding this playbill, but he's leaving a little bit. There's just a little bit left to hold it together. And, and maybe, you know, maybe he can hold it together. And, you know, I think that we see fairly soon that he can't.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love that scene. And I love you know, the intentionality of everything. And it leads you, I think what I like about this movie so much is that it leads you, the intentionality of every single thing in this movie leads you to think about the intentionality of every single thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it very well could be Orson Welles was like, all right, well, just, you know, fidget in some way, right? But, you know, we see everything being shredded in this moment, in this 5 minute segment, right? We see everything being shredded as a repeating theme in this little chunk of the film. And he's shredding it, but he's not destroying it. It's like he's going to stay true to himself and his ideals. And that little piece of it will remain, and he'll see where everything else falls, right? When Charles Foster, you know, based on what Charles Foster Kane does with what he does, because he knows what he's going to do, right? Like, he knows in that moment he's going to write what he's going to write. And, yep. You know, just to me, that sequence reads much more, intentional than just passive, which is what I, the first few times I thought, you know, watching it, it's just something you do to waste time, right? But in being asked to sit down and watch this movie with, an eye toward intentionality I'm not to say critical. You've had actual critics on this program. You've had experts. I'm just a guy who really likes this movie.
Well,
like, to me, being asked to think about that, I'm sitting here asking myself, whoa, that feels like a lot deeper than maybe it seems right on its face.
Okay. Again, I had never thought of it that way. I just thought, well, he's just bored. He's just really bored, and he needs a project, because he's going to be sitting here for 3 hours as Susie just sings off key. And then there's
and they don't have air conditioning.
And that, oh my god, everybody's in suits. Mm-hmm. And then there's a great shot of an over the shoulder shot of Kane as he's watching her perform. And once again, it's a trick of the visuals, because it's in this darkened theater. So we don't see anything other than the key light on the stage as she's singing. And then we see the over the shoulder shot of Kane. And it gives the illusion that he is in this cavernous hall that he has built. And of course, it's not. It's two pieces of film stitched together. And this, you can't see the scene because it's in total blackness. And once again, Welles is able to put across the feeling of an epic, probably made on a relatively low budget. RKO, after all, was not one of the hugest studios in the world. They were certainly an A studio, but they were an A-minus studio. You know, they weren't MGM. They weren't Warner right. Brothers. And so he had to kind of piece these things together. And, you know, it's great. Again, you don't even think about it. You're like, oh, yeah, it just looks like he looks like he's a full half mile away from the stage because he's up in the balcony. But, of course, you know, they didn't have the space to build anything that big. So, again, it's just that I love all the – this film is so full of special effects, but they're special effects that do not call attention to themselves.
They're invisible.
Yep.
You know, like the specialness of them is lost because you believe them so perfectly. Like, that scene, that whole scene in the opera, like, she's facing out into the air quotes crowd, but it's just a black room. They cut in tight on people's faces, and you hear other people behind them, or you see them just over their left shoulder. You get the impression, that there is this vast, opera house, that is filled with people there to laugh at poor Susie. And there isn't, you know, it's like probably what, 12, 13 people plus a crew.
Yep. Probably. Yep.
And it's like, that's just astonishing. Like, you know, Orson Welles is a professional liar, right? Like, that's what he does. Everything that comes out of his mouth is a lie. Everything he does is a lie. And he loves that about himself. And he, that's how he likes to engage in the world. It's like, I am tricking you right now. And I love it when you know that I'm tricking you. But I love it even more when you don't know that I'm tricking you. And then later I can say, guess what? There was 12 people in a crew. And I just, his enthusiasm is palpable in these movies, in this movie. It's just, it's so great. And it's hard not to get excited about that when you're watching it.
Oh, totally. That I've said that across different shows at this point, Film and Water and this show and Fade Out about, I love movies made by someone who is in love with making a movie and is able to convey that to the audience. Even if the subject matter is pretty dour, there's an exuberance. And I think about the opening credits to Boogie Nights. That's the example I always use, because I remember seeing that movie and, the title of the movie is in neon, and the song is playing. And I'm like, wow, PTA is just like, this is awesome. We're making a movie. That's just very, very charming. And you're kind of on their side already, you're like, all right, I'm on board. Let's do this.
Star Wars, same thing. A New Hope, I guess we're supposed to call it now. Star Wars. Star Wars, same thing. It starts with that big bombastic fanfare and the words scrolling. We are having fun. We are making this really, just this really incredible fun thing you've never seen, but reminds you of things that you know you've seen. And he's so excited about that. And you feel that when you sit down to watch the movie, you feel it immediately. And which is why I think, to be honest with you, in the prequels, it feels a little cheap, because he's just riffing on something he's already done.
that's for Phantom Menace minute they did that, or Star Wars minute already did that. See if they talked about that over there. So we hear the woman say, oh, how perfectly dreadful, and Kane is his eyes are bugging out, how dare.
That was an intense look.
Yeah, man. Woo, daggers are shooting out. And then we cut back to Jed, and he has fully made confetti out of this thing, and he's blowing on it. It's like a great prop, that somebody on the Kane crew had to sit there with a program and, we got to make it so he can so it can spiral and he can blow on it, and it's made up all these things. Then we cut back to the opera coach, and he's getting all excited, and he gets so excited at one point that he gesticulates so wildly that he bangs his hand on the top of the little roof there. And, it's like a bit of physical comedy. And like we were talking about, it's Wells is so in love with movie making that he finds room in this film for every kind of sort of thing. This movie is considered by so many to be, homework, or it's dour. And then it's so serious. And yet there's a bunch of goofy jokes in it. Earlier on,
a minute of the Marx Brothers here.
That's a complete Marx Brothers thing of him, waving wildly, and then he bangs his hand, and even literally licks his knuckles, it hurt. And it's that kind of, you can argue whether that's still considered funny in 2021, but it's not like this movie is not without laughs or humor, or seeing the humor in some of the ridiculous situations that we find ourselves in.
Well, yeah, I think that's just it. I think the focus of ridicule in that moment is Susie, right? She's that's what you're there to do. You're there to ridicule her in that moment. You are complicit as a viewer of this film in this moment, right? And then Mr. Fancy Pants, in his directing cage, whatever he is, he smacks his arm, and he's ridiculous too, right? So just a reminder, don't take yourself too seriously here, Mr. Fancy Opera Guy. You're kind of ridiculous too. And it just, to me, those are the little moments that, I think that they sneak into this film, even ones that aren't necessarily funny, but just little moments where you have to consider, okay, your idea of what's happening in the movie is formed by the people responding to it, right, in the film. So, if your idea is that Susie is ridiculous, well, where are you getting that from? You're getting it from this invisible lady that said perfectly dreadful. You're getting that from this director who is frustrated and angry and incapable of, gesticulating without injuring himself. Like, you know, you're getting that from other people. There's all these other narrators, and how reliable are they about what's really happening here? And I like that it just asks you that question repeatedly, over and over again.
Yeah.
is this person relating this information to you in a reliable manner? Is a constant thread of this film, both you know, in the making of it, and the very idea of Charles Foster Kane, the very idea of Orson Welles. He's an unreliable narrator. It's what he likes. You know what I mean? Like, it's throughout, and there is never a moment when that's layered in to the film where I'm not just like stupid happy that it happened.
There's a reason why you made a movie called F for Fake. You know, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
He likes all that stuff. So Susan finishes with the big crescendo, and it's not good. And people, you know, they do their sort of bare bones clapping. And then the clapping dies down fairly quickly. It's just the clapping is just polite enough. And then everyone gives up the ghost. And, of course, Kane can't tolerate that. And so he is trying to single-handedly will the crowd into clapping more. And he starts, you know, angrily clapping, to the point where you're almost imagining he's probably bursting blood vessels in his hands because he's clapping so hard. And he's sort of manic as she gets handed all of these flowers. And again, in a sort of ridiculous notion that all these wreaths are being thrown at her, and she's almost falling over trying to pick them all up. And then she wanders off the stage, and he stands up and he's clapping, clapping, clapping. And then the lights go out, and then it dawns on him that he is literally the only man clapping in this theater, and he is calling attention to himself of how ridiculous that is. And he catches himself and stops, and he just stands there. And the film is dead silent for a couple of seconds there, as, you know, Kane realizes how awkward this is, and that he knows it did not go over well.
Yeah. That silence right there, that moment of silence, like, you know, in music, like the rest, the rest note is really important, because it breaks up scenes, it breaks up ideas in the music. Those moments of silence are really, really critical. And like that moment of silence in, you know, and we're talking about a time in movies where being able to fill them wall to wall with sounds was a new idea, right? He's like, nah, we're just going to keep it quiet right here. Real quiet, and y'all are going to be awkward, and you're going to be looking over around at people like, oh, what happened here? You know, and I love it. You feel what he feels in that moment, just by eliminating sound. It's great.
Yeah, it's a really great way to end the scene. And then there is a hard cut to a close up of Jed Leland's column, which appears in the Chicago Inquirer, and it's stage views by Jed Leland. And there's a couple things worth noting about this little column. First of all, if you zoom in on the film, if you can like manage to do that, zoom in on the column that you see in the paper. If you look closely, it is the review that Kane ends up finishing for Jed. Mm-hmm. It's the actual column. Like, they didn't just put in, you know, ipsum loquitur, you know, all that fake gobbledygook in newspapers to just fill up space. And secondly, of course, for anyone who is a obsessive Orson Welles fan, you know that this little box here, the little graphic of Jed, Joseph Cotten as Jed Leland, this would be the seed from which would grow the Orson Welles cinematic universe, because this exact column appears in a newspaper in the Magnificent Ambersons.
No.
So therefore, those two films exist in the same universe. Jed Leland is a character in both films.
There is literally nothing he didn't do first.
Exactly.
That's astonishing to me.
Oh, you never heard this?
No, I didn't know that. No, that's
oh, yes. To me. Yeah. Go to, if you just Google like Magnificent Ambersons, Jed Leland, you'll see the scene where there is a news. Now, of course, in reality, it makes no sense, because this takes place in 19, we're exactly sure when it is, but it's after when the Magnificent Ambersons took place. Ambersons takes place before when this is, but never, it's an inside joke. It's just meant to be a little bit of a funny thing. But yeah, I can remember the first time I saw it I noticed it and I went, where have I seen that? And then I was like, wait, Jed Leland, that's Citizen Kane. And so, yeah, here we go. Orson Welles, you know, he beat Kevin Feige to the punch.
So like Jed Leland is the Nick Fury of the Wellsverse?
I guess so. We're building a team. Wow. I mean, it's, yeah. Yeah, so that's the I love it. I love that Wells did that just as a little. I mean, I don't know whether it was Wells' idea or not, whoever was doing the. I mean, Wells had the same crew for Kane that he had for Amberson's because he shot Amberson's right. at RKO and stuff. So it may have been someone else's idea of like, just put in a little gag. But nevertheless.
Yeah, just a fun little thing. Yeah.
These two films do exist in the same universe. So there
that
you go.
That is fascinating.
So and then, wow. then we see the paper get angrily thrown aside by Susie, and Dorothy Cumming or really manages. I don't know how she, you know, she can do this. I guess she's an actor, you know, knows how to project her voice, but she brings this wonderful harshness to her voice now. And earlier she was sweet, even when she was the old Susie talking to Thompson, she had kind of a nice, slightly sing-songy voice, but here she's just shrieking. I mean, of course she is, because she's horrifically embarrassed. By this, because I see the review by Jed, not knowing, realize it's the review by Kane. But you know, she's like, what kind of a friend writes things like that? I mean, she is, it is hard on the ears, but of course it's meant to be because she is mortified.
She's so great in this sequence. It's amazing because I've watched this 5 minutes over and over and over again, probably 12 times in the last 2 weeks. Right. And you know, the way she just, you know, starts off with Charlie. And it's just this, like this, I don't like the word shrill in this, but it's just this very grating, intense, angry, but still, it's still a term of infection, of affection, right? Like she's calling him Charlie. She's not calling him USOB, but it sounds like she is, you know?
Yeah. And, right.
And my note, in this area, if I don't have a lot of negative to say about this movie, clearly I love it, I adore it. I will say I think her dialogue in this scene is not the most well written of the dialogue in this movie. I think a part of that is intentional because again she addresses like the class issues. Right. You know, she addresses that right up front in this scene, just straight up says it. And I think that maybe giving her this sort of way of speaking is intentional, from a screenwriting perspective, but I don't think it's the best dialogue. I think, you know, potentially it's very true to the character, but I feel like she had a moment to shine from a dialogue standpoint here that she wasn't really given. With what the words that were actually written, the way she delivered them, like anybody else delivering these lines, you'd just be like, this is not great. But she sings them. I mean, she makes you angry for her. She makes you sad. The whole thing, she does it, you know, but the words themselves, the dialogue in and of itself, I don't think it's the best written sequence of dialogue in the movie.
Well, what in your mind would you have preferred? I mean, now I'm asking you to rewrite Herman Mankiewicz, but I mean, what is it that you would think would be better to have heard her say?
You know, I think it's just a little broad. It's a little caricaturish.
Okay. A little too on the nose of her.
A little too on the nose. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. A little too, you know, she's a low class Chicago shop girl, you know, who is sort of thrust into this world that she, you know, that frightens and confuses her. but like, you know, I just, it's just a little too on the nose and it doesn't give you any space to interpret on her behalf. Whereas everything else is very like, ooh, what are they really saying here? What, you know, the way the lines are written throughout the rest of the film, even something as simple as, like I referenced it earlier, when Leland, I think it's Leland, oh, maybe it's Bernstein, one of them refers to her as Susie, right? Like
they both call her that at different points.
Yeah, like that's really charming. That's that is a very sweet moment, and you know, it forces you to ask questions about their relationship, right? Their relationship to her, and this doesn't force you to ask any questions. It's just very on the nose. It's very caricaturish. It's got that flow from Alice kind of eye, you know, sort of kiss my grits kind of thing.
And, gotcha. And, okay. All right.
It just, to me, I feel like this is her big moment. And I know every guest you've had has said this. This is the crux of the movie. This scene is where
everybody says that their 5 minutes is the crux of the movie.
This scene, and I'll get into it momentarily, is when the movie turns. Maybe not the movie, but the character of Charles Foster Kane. This is where the narrative becomes unambiguous and for everybody involved, right? Like Jed's figured it out. Susie's figured it out. and Charles is about to figure it out. And Mr. Bernstein's probably still, you know, he's Team Charlie all the way. So,
yeah,
you know, that is what he's ride or die. But like, you know, I just, for me, from a dialogue standpoint, from the way it was written, I would have preferred slightly less on the nose, sort of central casting kind of dialogue for her.
Okay. Yes, I can see that. So he answers the door. There's a knock at the door at the hotel room they're at, and it's a delivery boy. This is the delivery boy is played by an actor named Gerald Pierce. He passed away in 2011. I mean, he's very young here. So, I mean, he, you know, managed to hang around for a long time. But, yeah, he was in – he had a bunch of films. I mean, he's uncredited in every movie. So he really didn't have like a huge career, but he was in The Stranger, directed by Orson Welles. He was in The Lady from Shanghai, directed by Orson Welles. He was in I Married a Witch with Frederick March and Veronica Lake, which is a great movie.
Yeah.
And Ball of Fire with Barbara Stanwyck. So, I mean, even though he always, I think, probably just played delivery boys and people that never got credit, maybe had one line. Nevertheless, that's a bunch of impressive credits. And, you know, he lived all the way to 2011. I mean, man, I hope that he dined out on this the rest of his life. I hope he was constantly telling people, you know, I was in Citizen Kane. I'm like, that's pretty damn impressive. Cause you're not expecting someone in the 21st century to be able to say that.
Right. And late in the 21st century.
Yeah.
Like, well, I guess early in the 21st, but like, do you know, was he a Mercury player? Was he?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with the name to know whether he was a Mercury player or not. I'm betting not. I think just because I think he probably just wasn't big enough, you know, like he was just a contract player probably by RKO.
Right.
And they hired him. And then obviously I think Welles liked him enough to put him in subsequent films. Again, that is just a complete guess on my part because he does have credits pre Kane. Which suggests to me that he was already in Hollywood by that point, by the time that Welles and the crew came out.
Right. And all of those Mercury folks came over from the East Coast to make this movie. So,
So he gets a delivery and it's an envelope and it's from Jed. And of course, Susie is enraged that, Kane wrote Jed a check. For like, well, I think it's like $25,000, which 1941 money is, that's a lot of money.
Joke.
That's, I mean, I'd love to get a check for that now, let alone 1941 money. And then we see, Jed has done with the check. And again, I love that Welles doesn't hold your hand here in that, Kane opens the envelope. He's in that wonderful smoking jacket with a big K on it, but he opens the envelope and he upturns it and we just see paper fluttering out, and we know that's the check has been returned.
Like the way he delivered that line.
He doesn't say it's not like, hey, this is the check. They just, you have to know Jed's not taking the money.
Well, you know, in that sequence, she's like, you gave him a check for $20,000. And he's like, yes, a check for $25,000. And that's, you know, he's saying that, and then like suddenly all those little pieces of paper. you don't need to be told, right? Like, you don't need to have your hand held to intuit what just happened.
Right. I think that's great. And then the other piece of paper included is the Declaration of Principles, which we saw, of course, earlier on in the film, which and Jed even says to the copy boy in that scene, when you're done with it, give it to me. I think this is going to be a pretty important document. And I mean, he ended up being right, not in the way he necessarily expected. But I think, again, it's very instructive that Jed held on to that all of these years later. I mean, you're talking at least 25, 30 years later, he's held on to it. And initially, when he's keeping it, it's meant as a compliment to his friend Charlie. And in this instance, it's meant as a dagger, that it's a reminder of, look how far you have strayed from where we used, you know, you were when we were starting up the newspaper. So, and Kane reacts to it appropriately by ripping it to shreds, because he, of course, is insulted that Jed is reminding him of this. And of course, he's hoping he can, you know, destroy it by literally just tearing it up when he knows that it is really, really stinging. I mean, Jed has managed to deliver a haymaker through this small gesture.
You know, yeah, but it's funny because I think that a part of it is also meant to be a lifeline. It's meant to be a reminder. Like, look, I'm not taking your money because I am principled. You were once too. Look, read this. Remember who this person was. Like, I feel like Jed is giving him chance after chance after chance after. And even in this moment, it's a chance, right? Like, what I was alluding to earlier with the tearing up the playbill, but leaving a portion of the playbill still intact. There's still it's still recognizable as a playbill, right? He's still recognizable to Jed as Charles Foster Kane, and he wants to remind him of that. Right. And it's Kane that decides in that moment that it's an insult.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And he makes the decision. This is why I say this is the moment when the film, or at least the character, pivots. He decides, I am the villain now. My principles, I don't need them because I'm rich. I get what I want. My reasons satisfy me. Right? Like, he makes the decision in that moment that he is going to shred his principles because he wants to. And that's really it. That's really it. And to me, that's the moment. That is where he's been the villain, right? In the somewhat confusing timeline of his life. He's been the villain repeatedly up until this point, but he's never really chosen it, right? Like as a choice, like I am going to do the corrupt thing, not just the wrong thing, right? He's done the wrong thing plenty of time. He's chosen the wrong thing plenty of time, but this is the corrupt thing. He's choosing corruption in this moment. And I just think the fact that, you know, Jed tore up that check and then he tears up the
Declaration
of Principles. And then Susie spends the rest of, or much of the rest of her timeline trying to put pieces back together, right? Trying to reassemble these things that have fallen apart. You know, to me, that's all very intentional. That's all very designed. Like when I watch that, I don't feel like I'm being led down a primrose path with these thoughts. I feel like this has to be what he was thinking.
Right. Jed is affirming his principles and Kane is destroying his.
Yep.
At that point. I know it's interesting. I never really considered that by sending the declaration, Jed is throwing his friend one last lifeline. Because by this point we've seen them have their final moment together. And it's pretty ugly. So I always sort of took it slightly as Jed, who has got an impish sense of humor, was almost doing it to just stick it to his, not in a mean way, but just kind of reminding his friend, but not really assuming that it would anyway be successful, a lifeline.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, I really get the vibe that up until this point, Jed is, maybe even after this point, I don't think Jed ever had a meanness to him, right? Like for me, he really just wants to do what they set out to do. And he really just wants this person to be the man, the great man he knows that he can be. And he's just perpetually disappointed and ground down and beaten down by that disappointment. And even in the scenes where he's in the little FDR outfit, you know what I mean? The wheelchair with the blanket over his lap for some reason, even though he's clearly in a tropical location. Like that whole sequence, like he doesn't seem angry, you know? He just seems disappointed. This was such a waste. Like, at least that's the vibe I get.
No, that's true. I'm sort of willing
to give him the benefit of the doubt in that regard.
That's true. He never does seem angry at his friend. It is more disappointed. It's more just like, you're so much better than this. And you're sort of pretending that you're not. And that's very disappointing. So after he tears up the declaration, there's this great shot of Dorothy coming where his face is just in this sort of rictus of rage, and behind her is this big bouquet, and it says success in all caps, which is gotta just be said, you know, oh man, she's got to turn around and see this thing mocking her.
Yeah, now that is a dig.
Oh man,
it's 100%, like, no way around that.
Oh man.
Yeah.
So they get into this fight. He tears up the thing, and he's squinting at her, and he basically says, well, you're going to continue. You're not quitting, and because I that's what I want. And again, he's just totally not listening to this woman supposedly that he loves. And then we get this big close up of Susie as she becomes enveloped in shadow, just completely covered in darkness. And you only even just see this bare light in one of her eyes. It's so dark. And I mean, of course, yeah, the symbolism is pretty hard to miss there. It's Cain is just blotting her out entirely. Yep. I mean, she has no agency of her own, no nothing, and she's realizing this. And then there's a slightly pullback shot where she's on her knees, and then she sort of sits down kind of on her posterior and pulls out of the shadow a little bit, and her face is half covered in shadow as she's looking up at him. And, you know, she's realizing, and she's breathing very heavy, and she's realizing in that moment, oh, okay, this marriage is essentially over. It's not over technically, but it's over for in any sort of romantic sense, because he's just gone now. She is just merely a puppet, one more puppet that he is pulling the strings of, and she's seeing it in that moment. And what a terrifying thought to know that you're bad at opera and you're about to go have to spend however many months on tour singing for people knowing they're going to hate you. That is brutal.
Awful. Like, it is so abusive on just a fundamental level, right? Like, what he does to her, what he chooses to do to her in this moment, just because he wants to, just because he said she's fantastic and he's not going to let the world or reality or facts tell him otherwise, right? Like, just, and how awful to be her, right, in that moment, and just to be that angry and that powerless, and then to have all of your light blotted out, and to have, you know, him tell you what you're going to, this person that you thought was going to be, you know, kind of your lifeline. It's awful. It really is truly one of, I think, one of the most villainous scenes in cinema that I can think of. You know, it's violent in a way that you don't really think of as being violent, right? But it is. I mean, it's just awful. Like, you just have no, you have, like, you know, like so many other people, just given up on him. I mean, you know how things end for him right out the beginning, right? But you've just given up. You know, I feel like there is a hope. I think you're looking for hope that things are going to end differently than you perceive that they have ended, you know, for him by the end of the movie. But in this scene, I don't want that for him anymore.
Yeah.
That's the scene where I'm like, you know, you deserve to die alone in a house surrounded by shit you can't even look at because it's still in crates.
Yep.
Good for you.
Yeah, he's making these choices.
Yep.
And then we get this montage of newspapers, and they're full of these headlines, which are hysterical in their nonsense. Brilliant diva established as operatic star. you know, I mean, Washington ovation for Susan Alexander. And, I mean, you're just like, this is just basically Fox News kind of stuff. Susan Alexander opens for San Francisco opera season, conquers dream of song. I mean, you're just like, oh my God, who's writing these things? And we see her just singing. And these 5 minutes are going to end on the St. Louis Inquirer saying St. Louis debut scheduled for Susan Alexander, as if somehow that is worthy of the top of the fold headline. There's nothing else going on in the news at this point that the debut of Susan Alexander as an opera star is somehow, that's the most important news you're going to find. And it's just like, you're seeing how far these papers have fallen under his sort of new stewardship, that this is what's going on. And that's the end of the 5 minutes.
I love that sequence too. Like, it's very, so many films come after and borrow so heavily from that like there are these moments where it's just these flickering little montage of movement and people doing things and the headlines and it's just this rapid eye motion of a scene, and then it ends kind of with the light bulb going dim, I believe. I think is the end of it, where it like it's you like just this, see the filament.
Yep. Yep.
Right. Like, this is it. There's no more light left. That's it. Just this tiny little filament that's like spreading no light at all. And it just, what a great frenetic bit of madness to end that scene with. Like, and not even like I don't know. I don't get the vibe that, you know, Orson Welles made this film with the intent of it to be, you know, observed in 5 minute increments, right?
No, like, I'm sure
and digested
doing that,
right? And digested in that way, right? But I'll be damned. I mean, I have been in the last 2 weeks, I have watched this movie repeatedly. I have watched my scene repeatedly. I have been binge listening to the other guests that have aired thus far. We've got some business there, by the way, before we end. Don't let me forget to get to that.
Okay.
And you know, there's been, I've been absorbing a lot of Citizen Kane. And I'll be damned if this 5 minute increment thing doesn't feel really just incredibly intentional, because that scene ends in this incredibly magical way with this really frenetic, angry blast of lies, right? Because these are all lies. That's all they are, is they're lies. And then, you know, just when you think, you know, and not even just when you think, but then they end and the lights go out. Like, that's amazing. And that all happened in 5 minutes. It's a perfect bit of punctuation to a 5 minute sequence. And I'm just like, wait, did he intend this? Like, you can retroactively give Orson Welles credit for everything.
It's amazing.
Like,
right. You know, yeah. It's amazing.
You know, I can't, his Marshall Plan was just brilliant. You know what I mean? Like you literally can get, but just in watching it and in listening to these episodes, you know, so much of what he did feels intentional, and 5 minute, this 5 minute window, it's perfectly bookended.
Yeah, it really works perfectly. And one other thing I wanted to mention as we are wrapping up these 5 minutes is, of course, this is really the big scene of Susan Alexander and talking about that she's not a good singer. And this becomes a data point that can be argued in two different directions when it comes to this movie. What I mean by that is, of course, we know that Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, saw this movie as an attack on him, and it's what made him so offended. And a lot of people that were probably inclined to be on Hearst's side over this snot kid Orson Welles' side was that they said, well, God, you know, obviously there's the rumor about the Rosebud, where the term Rosebud comes from. And then it's clearly an attack on Hearst. And the original title of this movie was The American, which is a name of a Hearst paper at the time. And then other people, you know, have gone further and say, you know, Wells was so vicious that he paints Marion Davies as this hopeless, inept, performer who only has to be pushed on stage by a rich guy. And that's how vicious he was, that he would slander Marion Davies. And Wells, later on in life, would make the exact opposite argument. He would say, well, no, everyone knew Marion Davies was good. She was actually a good actress. She was a good light comedian. And you can watch some of her movies. Some of them are available, like on DVD and stuff. And she's good. She's pretty funny. The fact that, and she basically gave up her career because she was with Hearst. But that was the argument Wells made, was like, no, this movie is not a biography or an attack directly on Hearst. And one of the examples of how I'm diverging from the Hearst story is, in my story, the Susan Alexander character is terrible, and that wasn't real life. So he was, they're making the same point. They're using the same point, but coming to two completely divergent conclusions.
Yeah. I think there's this, you know, I think I heard you tell the story about Orson Welles being, in an elevator.
Yeah.
With William Randolph
yeah,
Hearst,
supposedly,
right?
With Hearst. Yeah.
You know, Kane married Susie. Hearst never did.
No.
You know, there are all these sort of things where you can attribute. And, you know, I'm conflicted. I don't know where I fall on this. I don't know if I believe that this is about William Randolph Hearst in particular. But what I do think it's about, right, like, I think it's about the fact that the people that we consider great men, particularly in America, particularly post-depression, post-Gilded Age, right, in particular, the men that we considered heroes at that time were really villains. And I don't think that's an accident in this film, that the hero, quote-unquote, of the movie is a villain, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, visually speaking, almost repeatedly throughout the movie, you're being asked, well, is Wells a great man, or are the ceilings just really low? Right? Like, that's the question for me of this movie. And so, like, so when Hearst is like, yo, I take offense at these things, well, then maybe you shouldn't have done them. You know what I mean? Like, like, to me, Wells is shining such a bright light and focusing his lens so intently on an archetypal American, you know, we consider them heroes, we consider them great men, but really they're villains, right? Like, you know, Hearst got us into a war to sell papers. That's not make believe. Yep. Wells didn't come up with that. You know, but he's archetypal in that respect. He was kind of the last living, Gilded Age. He's the one that made it out alive, right? He's the Carnegie that didn't have a bunch of horrible sons. You know, he's the Rockefeller that didn't get his properties split up by the federal government, right? Like, he made it out. And if you don't like that lens being put on what you do or what you did or how you did it, well, then maybe you shouldn't have done it that way.
Right.
You know, I think those things, right? But then I also think, well, there's an awful lot here that's clearly William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah, right.
Clearly, you know, you provide the poetry, I'll provide the war. Like, that's not an accident, you know, and I think probably the most satisfying answer is that it's an amalgam of things. Like, William Randolph Hearst is archetypal of a certain type of American industrialist tycoon great man, and those men were not great, and that's the point of this movie to me. Yep. You know, is that the people that we, you know, are they great men, or are the ceilings really low? That's the question that I'm asked over and over with that movie. And, you know, there's sequences where, you know, Orson Welles, you know, that one sequence where he walks back to those windows and he just shrinks and he diminishes. Yep. And those windows are enormous, right? And then there's the scene where they're, you know, the in all the scenes, it seems to me, I haven't gone through and done the data, but it seems to me in all the scenes where it's a lie, where it's very, very clearly a lie, those ceilings are real low. You can see everything, you know? And it just, I don't know, like, that doesn't hold a lot of water to me, Orson Welles's explanation, right? That feels very convenient. As I said before, he's a professional liar. But it's very convenient for, you know, that she did turn out to be pretty good in the work that she did. It's mm-hmm. great smokescreen for him too, right? But I also don't think that it's terribly likely that, I mean, Mankiewicz was friends with her.
He was, yeah.
Right? I don't think that he would treat her, I don't think he would write a scathing, embarrassing character clearly based on her with the intent of hurting her. That, I mean, that being said, he was a massive alcoholic, so who knows?
Right, but I mean, it's inspired by, but not about. And that's a very right. easy distinction to make. I mean, I'm constantly making that distinction over on the Pod Dylan Show, where it's, you know, the songs are inspired by some event in his life, but they're not about that thing in his life. They're inspired right. by a person that he knows, but it's not about that person. And that's, I don't know why people, yes, sometimes when Welles is literally cribbing stuff that her said, you know, yeah, you could say, well, come on. But I mean, he's picking and choosing to whatever he wants. And so, yeah. And then if you go over even to like Marion Davies' Wikipedia page, it mentions that Welles spent a good portion, because she died in 1961. He spent a good portion of his later life when he would do interviews trying to correct the record and saying, no, yeah. Marion was great. Susan is not Marion. That's not yeah. what we're doing, you know? And I thought, that, you know, I mean, you could argue, well, he knew that that was probably going to happen though. And he did it anyway, but mm-hmm. at least on some level, he was sort of like, no, wait, I like Marion Davis. She was not untalented. She's not untalented. And she knew.
Right.
And,
and she wasn't.
And she wasn't.
Know, like,
was good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. I feel like there are arguments both ways. I tend to come down on the idea that while Kane, you know, was cursed in some regard, I don't think Susie or any of the other characters were anybody else in real life.
Yeah.
I just, why do that? You know?
Yeah. Exactly. So, well, all right. That's going to wrap up these 5 minutes. Wow, Corey, this is might be the longest episode of Citizen Kane Minute we've done to this point. Just talking about 5 minutes. Amazing what you can find in these 5 minutes at different intervals and stuff. So, is there anything else we wanted to say before we wrap up here on the show?
Well, I did want to follow up, and I have to take you to task about something.
Oh, geez. All right.
So, episode 3.
Okay.
I believe it was episode 3. You'll have to excuse me. I can't be quite as specific as I was with when I first saw Citizen Kane.
Yeah, wow,
but
yeah,
I listened to an awful lot of these podcasts. But I believe it was Citizen 3. You had a guest on, and who and the guest it told you that that Carey Mulligan was in an episode of Doctor Who.
Okay. All right. All yeah. Right. Yeah. All
and,
right.
Has Shag been a guest yet?
No.
No. And, in the event that he is not, I feel compelled, on his and Siskoid's behalf to just remind you based on the tone when you were like, Carey Mulligan was in Doctor Who? That must have been before she was famous. I feel like I need to remind you. Doctor Who's kind of a big deal.
Okay.
It's a huge show. Millions of people around the world love it. And Carey Mulligan was very, very good in Doctor Who.
Okay.
You and I will maybe we can watch that episode together.
Okay.
Because I think you would enjoy it.
Well, was I wrong though?
Were you wrong about it being before she was famous?
Yes. Yeah.
She had some credits before that, but she wasn't, you know, she wasn't who she is now.
Okay.
But the accuracy isn't why I am correcting the record, right? It was the intonation that...
Right, that Doctor Who clearly, was... that she was above Doctor Who at a certain point.
Right, I mean, you know, John Cleese at the height of his powers was in Doctor Who, but that's okay. Carrie Mulligan is, you know, she's...
Gotcha, okay.
You know, she would never have... No, I'm only teasing, but...
Right. I'm very glad that we took valuable Citizen Kane real estate to talk about Doctor Who.
I mean, I feel... Oh, well, now we're going to have to come back to that later on.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I'm going to start a podcast called "Why Does Rob Hate Doctor Who?"
I've said on before. I've tried to enjoy Doctor Who. It just leaves me sort of cold. And I even watched the ones with Karen Gillan because I figured at the very least, it's got one of the most gorgeous women in the history of God's green earth.
True, it does.
Yeah. You know, and even then, I was like, yeah, all right, Weeping Angels, great, okay. You know, it's just like, all right, but that's a conversation for another time and another show. So indeed, I appreciate you sticking up for Doctor Who. I really do appreciate it. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on, Corey. You know, I always enjoy talking to you. And of course, again, you've been a guest on across many shows here on the network, and you will continue to be on many shows across the network if any of us have anything to do with it. So thank you so much for coming on. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. I was happy to do it. I love this film. It is one of my all-time favorites. I love talking about it. I feel like we've not really ever talked about it before.
In
anything other than a casual way. So we're both probably just waiting for this opportunity.
Maybe so. I mentioned to you before we started, in my apartment complex I live in, comes with a private theater that you can rent out. And it is like seeing something in a movie theater, but it's, you know, it's really, I've done it a couple times now. It was closed due to COVID, but now it's open and I've used it a couple times and it is glorious. It is really fun. And you can you can put in whatever Blu-ray you want and it projects it onto the screen. And, we should watch Citizen Kane sometime. In that theater.
Yes.
We're not going to live here forever and we're trying to get as much use out of it as we can before we go. So we should watch Citizen Kane sometime because that would be really fun to sit there and.
Yeah. I guess by the time this airs, she will be my wife, because I'm getting married in the intervening window here.
Yes.
But we are current. She is watching Citizen Kane with me on our, you know, admittedly quite large television, but I'm sitting there wishing that I could show this to her on a big screen. So that might be a great night. Get some Mediterranean food and watch Citizen Kane on the big screen.
They don't allow food, but we've been managing to sneak it in.
Because
thank goodness my fiance has a large purse, so we're able to sneak food in and stuff. So, but of course, you will be able to see Citizen Kane on the big screen due to Fathom Events. And by the time everyone hears this, it'll just be a week or two away. Fathom Events will be playing it, I believe, on the 15th and the 22nd. So this is only another week. This is only about a week before that. So everyone will have a chance to go see it on the big screen thanks to Fathom Events around this time. So anyway, thank you so much for doing this. I always appreciate it. Of course, everybody, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at CKane Minute. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you're going to lock various rewards, one of which is a name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Slick. I really appreciate his/her support of Citizen Kane Minute. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Come back next week for more Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.
Muppets.